Chapter 26. Visionary. For once, Harry wasn't in the room with all the silver pictures. "Where are my captives?" he snarled, Voldemort's voice in his mouth, glaring at the lone, black-robed figure crouched prostrate on the tiled floor. "My lord," the man answered, voice high and tight with the effort to stay steady. "No one knows. Our agent said their ministry..." He paused, just long enough for Voldemort's patience to snap with a near-perceptible twang in Harry's mind. "Their ministry, what?" "Covering up for incidents. Murdered foreign wizards in their capital, my lord. And..." The man dared to glance up, blue eyes wide in his silver mask. "The disappearance of 5 citizens at the scenes." Voldemort sat back, the gilded carvings of a throne-like chair flashing at the edges of Harry's vision. "You seem to be implying that my Death Eaters failed their mission." "No answer," Voldemort continued, with scathing precision. "You mean to tell me that 12 fully trained wizards, fully trained Death Eaters, failed against 5 muggles?" The man's head shot up, shaking weakly in denial, fanning the flames of rage in Voldemort. "And now you have lost track of them? Crucio!" And then, black. Harry jolted awake to a familiar moonlit ceiling, all blurred shadowy arches and the scent of medicine. He blinked, and a dull ache bloomed from his scar and a heavy spot just over his left ear. "Ow." "You're awake." Neville's voice was soft, invalid quiet, and for a moment Harry was grateful it wasn't Ron shouting joyfully to make his headache worse. Then guilt surged, thin and faint, but it wasn't strong enough to really distract from the pain in his head. "Nev?" A warm hand clasped over his forearm, squeezing gently before retreating. "You're in the infirmary," Neville explained. "I found you passed out next to your bed. Madame Pomfrey says you whacked yourself pretty hard when you fell. Hermione and Ron went to get the headmaster about 10 minutes ago when your scar started bleeding. It's stopped now, by the way. And Madame Pomfrey left you a potion to drink when you woke. Would you like it now?" "Yeah." Ceramic clinked, then the rounded lip of a bottle pressed against Harry's mouth. The watery sludge inside was bitter, clinging to the back of his mouth and behind his teeth. But Harry swallowed gamely, feeling the ache in his head and the weight above his ear drain away. "Thanks." The doors opened. Dumbledore and Harry's friends walked in before Neville could answer. "Ah, good evening, Mr. Longbottom," the headmaster said, smiling. Ron and Hermione darted out from behind the man. "Harry!" Ron exclaimed. "You're awake!" Neville quickly pressed Harry's glasses into his hand, dodging out of the pair's way. "I'll see you later. Feel better," he murmured with a little smile, as Hermione caught Harry in a hug. Then, with a polite, "Sir," to the headmaster, Neville was gone, and Dumbledore took his chair. "Harry," he said, voice cutting softly through Ron and Hermione's clamoring, making them go still. Hermione drew away, putting a conversational distance between them. Dumbledore's eyes twinkled in approval. "How are you feeling?" "Much better," Harry answered. "Madame Pomfrey's potions are great." Dumbledore nodded. "Though one does wish something could be done about the regrettable taste, I'm sure." He sighed. "If I may ask," he let the question dangle, an unvoiced, "What happened?" hanging in the air. "What happened? Well," Harry ran back through the vision, then felt his mouth stretch into an unmistakable smirk. "Some attack of his failed," he explained. "Very, very badly. Dumbledore's eyes flew wide. Then, after a long, startled moment, his own smile widened into a bright, youthful grin. The next morning, with rain still falling and freezing upon the school, half the Ravenclaws, and a handful of assorted Slytherins and Hufflepuffs, came to breakfast with coppery, wizarding wireless radios slung over their shoulders like purses. Every single one was set to news programs, at least three different stations trying to drown out the others. Oddly enough, not a single Gryffindor sported a wireless, though several of them still bore signs of some very creative hexing. Kurama sat at the Slytherin table, munching slowly through a bowl of rice and trying to ignore the cacophony of competing announcers. "Splinched herself with a 3-foot icicle after illegally operating north. She is in stable condition. Cost of damages to the flu network estimated in the tens of thousands and rising. Spokeswizard for the night bus says the company will press charges of endangerment against Greta McGerbel for summoning to her home outside Glasgow. Bristletoe procession in Edinburgh Market has been postponed until flight conditions improve. The event has been held annually since 1412. There was a tiny part of Kurama that allowed himself to be smug, listening to all the oh-so-superior wizards scurry around in panic, just like muggle humans, and not a few of the more civilized demon nations, and certainly Rekai, did when nature threw them a curveball. A second, even tinier part, kept glancing at the two center tables, looking for any sign that Yukina and Keiko were listening to and, more importantly, upset by the news. But mostly, Kurama was unfazed by the dire reports. Though he definitely didn't like having only the radio as a source of information. At least the Tante, and by extension, the school, weren't as trapped as the wizards were, not with Yukina and Hiei perfectly capable of leaving on a moment's notice. A clap cut through both Kurama's thoughts and the radio noise alike, shutting every single wireless box off. Kurama glanced up to the professor's table, where Dumbledore was standing, face solemn and gentle. "I'm sure you're all worried about getting home for the holidays," the headmaster announced without preamble. A hush fell over the hall. "As you have all undoubtedly heard, all non-essential travel has been banned for the duration of the storm. I am sorry to say," a ripple of disappointment went through the quiet, "that few Aurors would accept getting home for Christmas as essential travel." The light words fell flat. Dumbledore continued. "To those of you already wondering about portkeys, there is no one on staff authorized to make one. I must ask that no one attempt to make one of their own, as an improperly cast portkey invariably renders a rather horrific death upon the maker." A pause, while Dumbledore cast a severe look around the room, pausing at a few of the more determined upperclassmen. Then he beamed. "So, if you would please attempt to entertain yourselves this morning, your professors and I will arrange some activities to be announced at lunch." With a second clap and a shooing gesture, the students were dismissed. Kurama stood, slipping past his housemates without a second glance for the way their calculating eyes watched warily out from behind perfectly normal expressions, and joined the flow of students out. He stepped quietly around a knot of first-years clinging to a Hufflepuff prefect, dodged a Ravenclaw with a gleam in his eye that screamed "library," hooked two fingers in the back of a red-trimmed collar, and tugged Neville out of the crowd and halfway down a side staircase before the boy managed to twist free. "What?" Neville's eyes fell onto Kurama, and alarm gave way to complete bewilderment. Kurama let his expression gentle, and tossed the boy a charmed wool cloak. "I have some errands to run. Would you like to come with?"
Sure.
"Errands?"
"It's solstice," Kurama explained, as they headed the rest of the way down the staircase. "Some ingredients work differently if they're harvested today." There was just enough space at the bottom of the staircase for them to stand abreast and pull open the heavy oak door. A layer of ice, 2 inches thick, hung in an icicle-fringed curtain just outside the door's alcove. "What ingredients?" Neville asked, shoving at the ice and letting it fall in glassy, crashing heaps. "Holly, ivy, hold on." Kurama caught at Neville's arm, using it for balance as he lifted his foot and grew a thorny vine around his boot. "Crampons," he explained, growing another vine around his other foot. Careful to keep the sturdy thorns pointing outwards. "We'll break our necks trying to walk without them. Where was I?" Neville helpfully parroted, "Holly, ivy," as he wrapped brambles around his winter boots. "Ah, yes." Kurama stepped out into the weak daylight, flipping up his hood against the frigid rain. "Them and pine and mistletoe." Neville stumbled right into Kurama's outstretched hand. "Careful there. It's a little tricky at first, walking in these."
"Mistletoe?" Neville squeaked.
"Something about maintaining the school brooms," Kurama replied guilelessly. "I wouldn't know."
Neville fell silent after that, saving his breath for the march to the outer walls. Then, the slippery scramble downhill past Hagrid's hut. By the time they reached the edge of the trees, Kurama was soaked through, and only the warming charms on his cloak were protecting him from a dangerous double dose of frostbite and hypothermia. And they hadn't even started yet. It was going to be a long day. Within the forest, ice gave way to wet leaf mold, the tree canopy having blocked out most of the freezing rain. Kurama pulled the thorns back into the vines, even though the wet leaves were almost as treacherous as ice. But leaving the crampons well spiked was just asking to end up with a giant pile of leaves stuck to each foot. Like Neville had now. Kurama chuckled and showed Neville how to retract the thorns. Then he tugged at Neville's hand and knelt, the boy following. "Let me show you how to navigate without a map," he said, scooping leaves away until the ground lay bare, a few thin traceries of winter brown bracken cutting across it. Kurama pulled Neville's hand to the dead stem on the ground, digging their fingertips in until he sensed life. "Think of the magic like water," he murmured. "Let it pour in. Don't try to direct it or force it." He could feel the web of the fern's root system, spreading outwards between leaves and true dirt, running over other roots, which webbed out even further. Some dug into the soil, centimeters deep, meters deep, spreading in thick humps that pushed thick discs towards the sky. That was the tree system then, and the magic wouldn't rise more than a few inches without sap running. Further, further, look for rising sap, a conical shape, leaves broad and spike-tipped and thick-skinned, there.
"Find the holly?" he asked Neville. The boy's eyes opened, glazed and uncertain, so Kurama pointed with his free hand. "That way, high spot, shaped like a pine tree. Feel how the magic spreads flat at the very edges, and how it bounces back like there's a layer of rubber over it. That's a waxy broadleaf, and the thready bits coming off are the spiked points. That's holly."
"Wow."
"Pull gently back in, like you're drinking from a straw." He waited until he couldn't feel Neville's power in the roots anymore, then pulled their hands out of the dirt and kicked the leaves back into place. Neville swayed slightly, eyes slowly coming back into the focus.
"Neat, huh?" Neville asked, not expecting an answer.
"But it can wear you out rather quickly, and it's got a limited range. I'm sure you noticed." Neville nodded, and Kurama went on. "Plus, it leaves you vulnerable to anything nearby and hungry, and it won't do much for helping you find roads and towns. Any empty stretch you find could be a stone ridge or a river or a lake instead of civilization. So stick to maps if you have the option, okay?"
"Okay."
They set off in the direction of the holly. Kurama had chosen to start with that tree for the simple reasons that they'd be more likely to grow near the edges of the forest, where the trees were more spread out and let patches of sunlight through for other trees to grow in, and that holly was one of the easier trees to start off with. Other broadleaf trees were hard to find the shape of, the way their leaves diffused the magic instead of bouncing it back off a waxy coat, and pine needles didn't allow enough space to feel the sensation very well. "Keep an eye out for mistletoe," Kurama said, as they clambered over a ridge. He sensed more than heard Neville try not to react. "It'll look like a nest, like a clump of leaves stuck in the branches, only green." Not that they were likely to find any on this path. Hagrid had described the directions to a few mistletoe clusters all too well, and Kurama planned to circle around past them on the way back. Soon enough, the forest opened up again, a sheet of paper-thin, lumpy ice crackling in the hollow around a tree, almost, but not quite, like a pine. Kurama and Neville regrew the thorns on their crampons and tramped down slope. Unsurprisingly, a layer of ice a couple centimeters thick covered most of the leaves on the tree, melding together in a slick, translucent mass. Kurama spread the trailing bulk of his cloak over the protruding branches and held it there. "When the leaves come loose," he told Neville, "we'll pick them individually. Don't force it if a leaf doesn't want to come off. And don't pick off any of the twigs. The magic will take it as a threat and flee back to the root." Neville nodded, but curiosity shone in his eyes as he asked, "Is that how it works for all of them?" "Very good," Kurama murmured. "That's how it works for the pine family. Mistletoe's magic will escape into its host unless you use a gold blade. I've got one in my boot." He offered a small, wry grin. "Professor Sprout had to tell me that. As for Ivy, Ivy's easy. If you ask it politely, eventually you'll find a plant that doesn't mind dropping a few garlands right off the wall. We'll do that back up at the school." He pulled his cloak free, water dripping freely from the heavy wool and holly leaves alike. Then began brushing roughly at the branches. The leaves didn't exactly shower down, even after Neville joined in, but Kurama had put just enough of a call into his hands. "Loose? Where? Come!" That a respectable steady fall began piling greenery up at their feet. Fortunately, holly could touch the ground. The mistletoe would be harder. "Neville, if you would." Kurama flicked a seed out, sprouting a deep, dried-out pitcher flower between two fingers. Neville took it and started scooping leaves inside. The impulse came out of nowhere. "I'd like to ask a favor." In the corner of Kurama's vision, Neville stilled, but Kurama didn't pause to face the boy. There is something important happening tonight. Yukina dancing solstice, Hiei near comatose on the fire hearth. And you know our classmates." The momentary reflex to kill, Harry's eyes, huge and bewildered in the firelight, flitted across his memory and vanished. "It's none of their business." Neville tilted his head. "What are you asking me to do?" "I'm not sure, actually," Kurama admitted. "If you can think of anything that would distract Gryffindor, keep them in the house. I can handle Slytherin, but, well..."
"Harry?"
Kurama chuckled ruefully. "It's that obvious."
5.5 years, Neville answered. "Kind of hard not to notice the trouble he gets into. But if you can get me a couple of cases of fire whiskey..."
Harry woke with a screaming headache. Again. And a taste rather like a moldy sock had been shoved in his mouth. And for some reason, he was still half-dressed. His pillow was under his feet, and he had the strangest feeling there were still a few feathers sprouting from his ears. Oh, right. Second night of the Snake Faces attack failed somewhere party. Up Gryffindor and all that. Where was the pepper up? One hand patted near his head, not finding anything. Harry stretched, finding the edge of the mattress. Straight down. Try not to sway the curtain too much. Ow, daylight,
evil sun. It was gonna get hexed if it kept up that Merlin curse shining. And there, safely out of the way of clumsy feet, a familiar bulbous little bottle sat in the lee of the bedpost. Harry scooped it up and drank. Steam whistled from his ears, killing the evil little gnome that had been swinging a red-hot pickaxe in his head. And suddenly, the world came into focus. Weak daylight spilled through the windows, perfectly innocuous, and nothing like the evil shining of before. Somebody must have spiked the butterbeer. And, as images of silver frames in an empty room, pictures of fire and glittering boxes trickled back into his mind, somebody else, of the bushy-haired and brilliant variety, must have neglected to make sure he was sober before reminding him what last night had been. Solstice, another of the cross-quarter visions. Harry dug into his trunk, conveniently right there next to his head, and dragged out a quill and parchment. Inkpot, inkpot, there, jammed in between his bundled-up Dursley clothes and a forgotten bag of Honeyduke's fudge. Now why would he have left a half bag of fudge to go to waste? Wait, it had been in his school bag back on Halloween, unsupervised while he'd rung up firsties in the twins' makeshift shop. Okay then, gift for the twins. Harry dipped his quill into the ink and began to write down what he remembered of the vision. It was fairly easy. This one hadn't been all that much different from the previous three, though it had lacked the clinging, protective blue-green mist from Halloween, and the images in the frames were getting clearer every time. Fire, darkness, light flickering off spindly square box edges, every frame a different place, inside a warehouse, a barn, out in a field, under cold rain. So at least one spot was in Scotland, somewhere in the peculiar empty black that spoke of the night sea. In the smallest frame, there was an entirely different quality of blank blackness, the only frame lacking fire, lacking anything at all, really. As he continued writing, trying to get the fading memories out on paper before they vanished, he heard his doormates start to wake up. Low groans, much like his own had been, some thuds as someone stumbled out of bed and made his zombie-like way to the bathroom. A high-pitched squeak and a slap of running, light feet. A hint of fake flowers in the scent. Harry decided he didn't want to know who'd fallen asleep in here instead of her own bed. Or why? Harry finished with a quick, bad sketch of the pictures on the vision's wall, then charmed the ink dry and stuck them into the pocket of the first clothes he found in the trunk. A pair of Muggle jeans, perfectly fine for breakfast, since he wasn't some stuck-up Slytherin. A couple freshening charms saved him from risking the bathroom, and left him smelling, if not fresh as a daisy, at least not like he'd been in a Gryffindor party all night. An oversized sweater, that, for once, hadn't been Dudley's, and shoes. Skip looking for his brush, since it made no difference, and Harry headed out with a cluster of first and second years. He found Hermione already at the table, a book open next to her plate, and a slightly wistful expression as she watched exuberant Ravenclaws jostle each other at their table. Harry followed the look. Huh, the Hufflepuffs looked pretty happy too, though the Slytherins were just as sullen as ever, then plopped down next to his friend. Morning. What's going on? Hermione turned a long-suffering stare on him. While we, and by we, I mostly mean all of you, were dancing, singing off-key, playing how many people can we fit into the ceiling arches, and attempting to break records for chaos at Hogwarts, which you didn't, by the way, thank Merlin, the Ravenclaws were holding competitive debates. She finished in a low wail. Oh. Given Hermione's idea of fun really didn't include drunken singing. I'm sorry. He scrambled for something to say that didn't sound stupid, and paper crinkled in his pocket. Oh, maybe this will cheer you up, he decided aloud, handing over the scribbled description of his quarterly vision. Sure enough, Hermione's eyes lit up. What's this? Oh,
Oh, it was last night, wasn't it? And she was off, breakfast abandoned and unguarded as she dived into the fresh information. Harry stole a couple sausages, just on general principle, and watched several variations of Hermione's thinking expression steal over her face. It was kind of funny. Ron had catalogued a few of them over the years. There was Ye Old Spelling a Failure, promptly followed by its near twin, which Harry had named Grammar is Knowing Yoda, Yes. Then, both of them were overthrown by the more intent looks Hermione got when she started reading for content instead. 13, she eventually murmured, and, you're sure he's not aware you're seeing this? She gestured at the page, fingertip running crosswise over center frame, YKW cursing ice away. Valley didn't have Muggle streetlights. No, Hermione, Harry said dryly. I actually think he's doing it on purpose. Oh, look what I'm doing, neener neener. Hermione very nearly choked, giving him a wild-eyed glance. Are you sure you're not still drunk? Pepper up. Right, Hermione sighed. Still drunk. I am not. No, what? Ron shoved in on Harry's other side, yawning. Drunk, Harry explained. I took Pepper up. Oh. Waving a wisp of steam away from his own ear, Ron shrugged. Kinda, sorta. Makes you feel better. Makes you only mostly sober. Why? Later, Hermione warned, loading up Ron's plate. Breakfast is almost over. Ron looked down and went slightly green, and Hermione hid a superior little snort. Mostly sober, he says. The food vanished before Ron could respond, or eat anything, for which he looked grateful. And a loud clap drew Harry's attention to the front table, where Dumbledore had stood to beam at the assembled students. Harry could swear that Dumbledore's smile had sparkled when he glanced over the Gryffindors. Several of the more rumpled-looking kids, the ones who looked like they hadn't been able to find Pepper up this morning, whimpered. I see I'm not the only one who had a fun, if regrettably late, night, Dumbledore began cheerfully. Across the room, the Slytherins scowled en masse. A few announcements, then, and we can all go back to our beds. First, for when we're all properly awake, I must insist that students please refrain from leaving the roofed sections of the building. Despite the lull in the storm, there is still far too much ice on the grounds and in the courtyards for one's safety, and there are far too few brooms to allow students to share. Second, Professor Sprout had such success with last night's Portrait Plays Marathon that Hufflepuff is hosting an open house showing of their Christmas repertoire, starting this afternoon, right here in the Great Hall. Dumbledore gestured at a beaming Sprout. I believe they have an excellent rendition of You'll Be Home, a Transfiguration story. A happy murmur rippled through the younger students. And lastly, after much debate, the headmaster smiled even more brightly. The staff and I have decided to hold a full school masquerade on New Year's Eve. Noise. Somewhere behind Harry and across the table, Yusuke groaned. Masque what? Hermione turned. Masquerade, she corrected. Out came expression number 9, simple words for simpletons. Harry and Ron hadn't been very creative early on. It's a fancy costume party. Oh. Cool, Yusuke decided. There gonna be food? Ron leaned back. It's never a party without food, he said sagely. Up at the head table, Dumbledore gestured for quiet. Your professors and prefects will be available to assist with costuming, he said, as if he'd actually asked the prefects. Harry knew he hadn't been asked, and Hermione would have never been able to keep from bouncing off the walls if she'd known. And I'm sure that the other upperclassmen will be delighted to lend a hand as well. Subtle. But considering half the school still wasn't entirely awake, and half of the rest were Slytherin, Harry supposed that subtle hints to help out the little kids wouldn't go much of anywhere. Behind him, Yusuke started chuckling madly.
What?
Kuwabara asked.
Just wondering something, Yusuke answered. What's Yukina gonna make Hiei wear?
Everyone within earshot paused. Then, the entire table burst into laughter.